Driveway Moments showcase the magic of public radio. Producers understand it's a process. I'm Public Radio Runner, and you're listening to Arizona Edition. This special takeover episode celebrates Dave Reek, our general manager. He shares his broadcast sojourns, navigating the analog to digital transition. A look to the past can help us appreciate the present and what the future may hold. Dave reflects on his career in radio from...
And there were times when I crawled around on the floor trying to find a syllable somewhere that I mistakenly cut out or something.
Two.
AI is going to have its biggest impact on amplifying our footprint on all these other platforms and helping us facilitate that.
This and more. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Arizona Edition, and I'm Public Radio Runner. You may know Dave in his current role as the general manager of KAWC and Border Radio, but 40 years ago, he caught a bug that introduced him to just about every job there is in radio. For more, we're headed to the high desert and ponderosa pines of Flagstaff, Arizona.
I've always been interested in the news and current events and politics and things. So I already had that interest, and then a friend of mine had me follow him one day while he was working at KNAU. And we went out in the field, and he recorded some interviews with some newsmakers. We took the audio back to the studio. We copied it from cassette to reel-to-reel. We edited the reel-to-reel tape. We did the final product, and it ended up playing out over the radio. And I was able to watch that whole process and thought, oh, my gosh, this is the kind of stuff that I like to do, I'm interested in, and I'm also fascinated and in love with technology, especially recording technology and things. And it just combined so many of my interests. And I thought, wow, this would be a natural fit for me. So the story was the CEO of Pinnacle West Corporation, which is the company that owns Arizona Public Service, came up to Flagstaff for some kind of a press conference. And I believe it had something to do with the role of nuclear energy in Arizona. I believe this was at the time that nuclear energy was just really going online for Arizona.
Interviewing high-profile folks as a junior reporter can be exciting to do and to witness. However, for Dave, the most memorable part of the interview was three letters.
One of the most impressive things about it to me was my friend. I mean, we were both in our 20s, and this millionaire guy stood there and took his questions and treated him like he was somebody because his microphone said NPR on it.
A 60-second news spot, known as the haiku of radio journalism, is a high-production piece. The institutional ethos of NPR on a mic flag is just an aspect of the process.
It was fascinating that my friend spent probably about 3 hours gathering the tape, going back to the studio, doing all the conversion of it, final editing, and then it was on the 5 o'clock news. It really impressed on me how important media is, you know, of course, to listeners, but to newsmakers and to individuals, of having a conduit to get their story out.
And radio journalism as a form of media is still important. Regardless if the internet is up or not, it's a means to communicate emergency alerts and local stories alike. Against the backdrop of our 24/7 news cycle and digital workflows, it's easy to overlook the feat of a same-day turnaround on a spot in an analog workflow. Dave takes us to the production room for a close-up on the process.
In the field, we had Sony, I believe they were, cassette decks with an XLR input for the microphone. We would get that audio, so it was mono audio. And then we would take that back, and then we would plug that cassette into a a tabletop cassette deck that was hooked up into the mixing board, and then we would dub that onto a reel-to-reel. Because with a quarter-inch reel-to-reel tape, you can play it back and you can isolate where the silence is between words. And when you find that, you would mark it with a grease pencil. And then the reel-to-reel machines had a little slot on the top where you could pull the tape up and set it in that slot, find your grease mark, and then with a razor blade make a splice, separate it, and then go to the other end of your other, your second grease mark, and you would hit that splice. Then you would take the pieces you want, and with a piece of vinyl tape, you would tape them back together again. And then when you played it on the reel-to-reel, you couldn't even tell.
Making a single word splice seems straightforward enough, right? Well, a standard 7-inch reel contained either 1,200 or 1,800 feet of tape. The sound bites or actualities used in spots and other pieces often comes from longer interviews, which means more tape. Dave walks us down memory lane for some tape management and other editing hacks from a friend and colleague at KNAU.
Was we had a row of literally nails tacked to the wall so that if you pulled out a big piece of tape, you could make a note on the back of it and hang it up on the wall in case you decided you change your mind, you decide you want to use it again later. Cindy Carpian is an audio producer. She had worked with NPR for many years. She used to be the field producer for Scott Simon. So showed me some great techniques, like if you're recording your audio and you make a mistake and you go back and you re-record it, when you go back to make a final edit, if you can find a word that you said in both takes, well, cut it in the middle of that word and splice it, and it'll sound perfect. Interesting tricks like that, she taught me, which is, really stuck out to me. But yeah, it was an interesting process, and there were times when I crawled around on the floor trying to find a syllable somewhere that I mistakenly cut out or something. It was crazy. Of course, on a small, like a spot, a rap like the one I was talking about, you know, it goes fairly quickly and you don't really notice it. On a larger piece where you may be using sound effects and multiple sources and things, it can get kind of complicated.
Sound effects, multiple speakers, and host tracks complicated the process because each source required separate reels. Hardware, or perhaps lack thereof, also constrained the process. Dave takes us through a special prod room at the KNAU station.
Actually, we had one production room that had three reel-to-reels, which came in handy because on a lot of the longer pieces, like, for example, if I went out to do a story about the Forest Service and a project they were doing on the Coconino National Forest, I would, of course, get sound of us tromping around in the forest or of a wildfire or something like that. And all of those sound effects would end up on one reel-to-reel. The people I interviewed would be on a separate reel-to-reel, and then my voice would go on top of that. And so you would have to synchronize firing off one reel-to-reel, firing off the other. Yeah, it could get kind of complicated. Sometimes you'd need more than one person to do it.
Whether you recruited another colleague for a sound-rich piece or produced a spot, final assembly of tape in the prod room wasn't the last step before broadcasting on air.
And then what I would typically do is I would play that whole thing back in real time and record it onto what they call a cart, which is it's an 8-track tape. I would just hand the news guy a cart and a piece of paper saying, this is what you say to set up this cart. So it would go from cassette to reel over to cart. And then that cart could be read by the evening news host, and then they could hand that cart to the morning edition host the next day, and they could run it again in the morning.
Airing a story for a local broadcast was resource-intensive and done live and in real time. But what about local pieces that were accepted by NPR for broadcast on a national level?
NPR would require you to send all of those disparate pieces put them all on a reel-to-reel with a list of what was there and what they were for. And then NPR would do the final mix themselves. They didn't want anything that was already mixed. They demanded that they have that final mix. Yeah, we would do all of that, put it all on a reel-to-reel, with all the notes, and then throw it in a FedEx envelope and ship it off to NPR.
Even in the digital age of waveform and multi-track editing, NPR still follows this practice. But sometimes you don't need to send your tape to the mothership because they come to you.
Cindy Carpian had invited Scott Simon to come out to Flagstaff. And she said, hey, come out. We'll visit because we're friends. But while you're here, we'll gather audio. You can do a couple of pieces that you can air on Saturday Weekend Edition later. And I'll produce for you. And NPR in those days, I'm not sure if this is still true, required their reporters to use a field engineer if they were out gathering tape. And so bonus for me is I got to be Scott Simon's field engineer, which meant I was responsible for carrying all the recording equipment and the mics and things. And then I worked with Cindy on dubbing all of that. I believe the piece was the one we did about what's it like to live at a high altitude. So Flagstaff is at 6,800 feet. So it turns out that when you live at 6,800 feet, you have to adjust how you bake and cook because water boils at a different speed and baking is different. And we did several other things. And then we mixed all those together into a piece. It was a lot of fun to do.
Although roughly 10 years had passed from the nuclear energy news spot to this one, reel-to-reel tape was still dominant in production workflows. But KNAU had recently acquired new digital equipment, and Dave was feeling adventurous.
So about 95 was when we bought our first digital audio workstation for the radio station. It was called an Arrakis system, and it was for automation, but it also had multi-track editing. Cindy and I were working on them. I said, look, Cindy, let's try dubbing the ambient sounds could be one track, and then Scott's voice could be another track, and then the interviewers could be a third track, and then we can mix it down. And she's like, well, NPR was going to require us to send them all on reel-to-reel anyway. I said, well, let's give it a try and see if it works.
Our story was produced by Cindy Carpian, with assistance from Patty Arias, Matt Martinez, and engineered by Dave Reek at member station KNAU in Flagstaff.
Well, we did, and it was the first time ever NPR accepted the fully mixed piece because, of course, Cindy did a fantastic job.
Dave's curiosity and Cindy's production skills would pave the way for a digital future. When we come back, more on how a simple program became one of the industry standard digital audio workstations, or DAWs, we're familiar with today. Stay with us.
Funding for Arizona Edition comes from listeners just like you. Your continued support allows us to bring you insightful conversations about issues and events impacting our community. Thanks to you, we are able to highlight the people and voices of Yuma and La Paz counties and encourage civil conversations around water, agriculture, healthcare, education, and much more. Please continue to tune in to Arizona Edition, and thank you for helping us keep our community informed.
We're back with Arizona Edition. I'm Public Radio Runner. Producing the high-altitude Weekend Edition episode with the Arrakis system was the first step toward an entirely digital future. An NPR satellite infrastructure upgrade in the 90s with digital output laid the foundation for hard drive waveform recording and editing with digital audio workstations.
There was a program, it was actually called Cool Edit Pro. And so you could load that on a PC. You could load all your audio on there, and then you could start lifting out little pieces and then assembling them. And the thing that was just like the, mind blown was if you made a mistake or something didn't sound right, the original piece was still there. It's non-destructive editing. And that really mean something when in the past you were cutting things with a razor blade and destroying them, literally. So I was like, wow, I can make mistakes and recover from them. And that was just a whole new world and just fantastic. And then it got bought by Adobe and became Adobe Audition.
Non-destructive digital multi-track editing fundamentally changed production workflows. The ability to record digitally to hard drives enabled a similar watershed moment for content distribution. To fully appreciate the modern distribution infrastructure, Dave reminds us of how things used to be.
When NPR first got started in, it was the early 70s, there was no satellite distribution. So what NPR would do is it would create programs and it would record them onto a reel-to-reel, which would go into a box. And the box had columns on the front of it. It was called a bicycle box. And what they would do is they would write down the name of the show and the length of it and the date that they sent it. And then they would put it in an envelope and mail it to a radio station. That radio station would broadcast the show and write down that they broadcast it, and then they would put an envelope and they would mail it to another radio station. That reel-to-reel would work its way across the country and get aired in different markets at different times. And so by the time the end of the week was up, it had been heard all the way across the country. But that was how they would distribute programming in those days.
But by 1980, NPR had completed a nationwide satellite distribution network.
The Public Radio Satellite Service, PRSS, was able to lease satellite uplink time, and then they would facilitate stations installing satellite dishes. They used what they call the K-band, which is a very large, it's about a six-foot-wide dish, so it's not like your Dish TV or something like that. And then you would point it at that special satellite, and then you would get a downlink. The original one that I interacted with in the 80s was the satellite signal would go into a bank of these devices. When you walked into the lobby at KNAU, and I know they had the same thing at KWC, there were a set of equipment racks, and there were five reel-to-reel machines mounted there. It would be the job of the operations people or the morning edition host, the All Things Considered host, to make sure when you walked in the door that all the right reel-to-reels were installed in the right reel-to-reel decks and queued up and ready to go before the timer would fire off the actual recording.
While the advent of satellite distribution solved the delivery problem, recording the transmissions presented its own challenges. Namely, that it required someone to physically hit record. Dave shares how Mr. Coffee and a little ingenuity went a long way.
Here in Yuma, our engineer John Gabry had figured out a way. He actually would buy the replacement timing devices off of Mr. Coffee coffee makers. And he would mount those in a little electrical box. And the Mr. Coffee coffee maker at 6 o'clock in the morning would send an electric pulse that would fire off the record button on the Atari reel-to-reel. And that's how we recorded radio programs from NPR. It was a brilliant piece of engineering. It helped because we couldn't afford to have people sitting here 24 hours a day pushing a button to make all the recordings happen.
Automating recording wasn't the only use of the Mr. Coffee timers. They also served as a solution to keep the station on air.
So the station started in 1970 and was AM only. And it's what they call a Class D AM license from the FCC. And a Class D license says that from sunrise to sunset, you can broadcast at full power. But when the sun goes down, AM signals go farther, because the sun naturally interferes with the AM signals. So when the sun goes down, we were required to reduce our power by about 80%. My predecessors at this station thought, well, there's no point in broadcasting it at 20% power. So they would just turn the transmitter off at night. When I arrived, I thought, well, that's a missed opportunity. An engineer taught me a long time ago that 90% of your listeners are listening to 10% of your transmitter. The people who live closest to your station are already being served by only 10% power. I was determined to come up with a way that we could broadcast at that reduced level. But of course, I didn't want to have to come out here at 4:30 in the morning and press a button. So working with my contract engineer, Dennis Gilliam, who's a protege of John Gabry, we figured out a way to use the Mr. Coffees to raise the power on the transmitter and lower the power on the transmitter. So once a month, because the FCC sends you has a chart that tells you in your time zone, this is when the sun rises and this is when it sets from month to month. So every month we would go and reset the Mr. Coffees to make sure that we were raising and lowering power at the right time. About a year or two ago, my new operations person figured out a way we could do it with a computer program. So now we've bypassed Mr. Coffee, but they're still here. That's practical engineering.
Increased automation beyond mechanical means, like the Mr. Coffee engineering hack, provided convenience for many stations, but it also came at a cost.
Well, a lot of people were a little hesitant. I mean, the big hesitation came on the automation side of running the station automatically and letting a computer do it. I mean, obviously, there was a concern about people losing their jobs or losing hours or things like that. All stations had to have 24-hour employees. So there were somebody sitting there 24 hours a day keeping the thing going. And more than half of those jobs went away as soon as automation came in. And even more than half, because then you, at the same time in the early 1980s, during the Reagan administration, there was a huge deregulation. And so not only did you need fewer people to run one radio station, but that fewer people could run multiple stations. In the past, there were limits on ownership. So all of a sudden, five people could not just run one station, but they could run 20 stations. And so, yeah, it decimated the industry on that side. One of the things that we kind of fight against in public radio is the sort of the homogenization. If only one person is serving 20 communities, how much does he actually know about 19 of those communities? He doesn't live there, you know? So, and that's what we fight against. And that's why this current controversy about should the federal government support public broadcasting, I think a lot of the debate is a little bit misguided. I think it's a worthwhile investment for the taxpayers to pitch in to make it possible for rural communities across the country to have local broadcasters who are providing this vital service. And when that emergency alert happens, having someone local there to respond and provide the local perspective, I think that's going to be irreplaceable. And if some stations end up failing because of a lack of support, it's going to be a real tragedy.
Perhaps the 1-2 punch of automation and the deregulation of the 80s can inform how we think about what's on the horizon, especially as it pertains to generative artificial intelligence.
What I'm learning now, even more so, when we launched a new podcast live radio show, and I'm learning about the value of taking one piece of content and creating shorts, little snippets that then can draw people to go listen to the full thing. And so I've learned that AI is a great tool for helping to do that. I still think AI is going to have its biggest impact on amplifying our footprint on all these other platforms and helping us facilitate that. I don't think AI is going to come up with any good ideas for local stories. I'm not sure that AI is ever going to care about what's important to our community. AI is not going to go down to the corner coffee shop and say, hey, what's happening in your business this week, or things like that. So I think we will always have that ability to provide that service to our community. When we can do a story about what's happening in this community and how people in this community are impacting their neighbors or addressing challenges or creating innovations, those are the stories that people click on from our website. And I think that's our news director, Lou, he likes to say local, local, local. That's what I think we will always be able to do better than an algorithm.
Locality, and dare we say hyper-locality, are the core elements of public radio. It's in our DNA, and it's what we're passing on to the next generation, like our award-winning student newsroom.
What I'm excited about is when we start working with some of these students and they come in and they say, oh, what's radio? Oh, okay. Oh, what's public radio? And they start to see what makes public broadcasters unique. One of the things that has been the driving force in my career and why I've been in this for so long and hope to never stop, is public broadcasters, they are members of the community, they're part of the community, so they're really serving their neighbors and their friends. We have a tremendous amount of respect for the communities we serve and for the people that we interview and talk to. We treat everyone with respect. It's those values that we bring to the endeavor that I believe come out of the speaker when you listen, come out, click on the video or the podcast. And that's what I'm trying to teach the next generation so that when I do ever stop doing this and move on and pass the baton, I want to make sure that next generation is ready to do the same thing. Because as I try to tell people, I think that is a critical part of a functioning democratic republic that we live in. And without that, it's going to be tough to have a successful nation that, you know, embodies those principles.
Public radio has come a long way, from the bicycle distribution of programming to the digital and satellite transmissions of today, or the evolution of recording to cassette and then transferring to reel-to-reel and then an 8-track cart. We've embraced digital audio workstations and are even venturing into video. But we'll always be a service, providing our neighbors, friends, and community with music, emergency alerts, and local stories. Arizona Edition is a production of KAWC Colorado River Public Media. Questions or comments are welcome. Send them to az@kawc.org. Connect with us on Facebook and Instagram. Our theme music was used with permission and composed by Stephen Hennig and performed by members of the Yuma Jazz Company. More information at yumajazz.com. Past shows are available online. Visit kawc.org or search Arizona Edition wherever you get your podcast. You can also take KAWC with you wherever you go. Just download the KAWC KOFA app and the listening is in your hands. I'm Public Radio Runner and this is Arizona Edition. Thanks for listening.